There are no dull moments in the media business at the moment, and by media we mean more than news, but all things basically that are disseminated to a potentially wide audience. The election of Donald Trump and his frequent use of Twitter mean we have turned a digital page in our culture. Now we've got the White House and news organizations fighting over facts and even alternative facts. So today we roll out a new segment we call Signals and Noise, a discussion of recent issues in media. Our regular guests are on the communications faculty at Southern Oregon University. Precious Yamaguchi has been here several times before. Good to see you back.
Hi, thank you for having me today.
And Andrew Gay is here as well. Good to have you here.
Thank you.
So, boys, both of you in communications, I wonder, just some general impressions about what you tell students about this moment in media history, particularly those who, you know, they're young enough to not really remember a time before the internet.
Yeah, it is a very interesting time to be teaching media literacy. I'm teaching media literacy right now to my students, and you probably, just like this show, we pick some topics this weekend, and already in some ways there's so much more to talk about since then. Same thing with my classes. I'll prep a class, and there's already something new about the media to discuss, and so I sort of have to throw out the lesson plan many times.
Same thing for you, Precious, with trying to get people to understand what the current climate is.
Yeah, and I think it becomes very confusing sometimes, because as I was telling my colleague Andrew, that Donald Trump tweets out so many very blunt and sometimes offensive messages on Twitter, and at the same time journalists are they're under a lot of pressure for what they're writing about and getting fired and getting discredited. So it's really difficult, I think, sometimes as a young person to understand, well, okay, my teachers and my professors tell me that I should be careful about what I post on social media. But in contrast, we have a president that has gained so many followers and so much attention on a daily basis by what he tweets, whether it's really offensive or it could be kind of interesting in what's happening with the climate. But then at the same time, there's journalists that are losing their jobs based upon their reporting.
Well, yeah. Let's talk about that, because that's one of the examples here. Lewis Wallace, a radio reporter, was fired from Marketplace because of something he put on a personal blog entry. And here's where we get into some interesting realms of the personal versus the institutional, what you will say through the microphone or the keyboard that you possess because you belong to an organization versus what you say in your own stuff. And his personal blog entry was called "Neutrality is Dead and I'm Okay with It." He questioned the meaning of neutrality in the face of an administration that's aggressively promoting fiction. His words, Lewis Wallace is transgender and says he can't be silenced. I mean, this is, I can't remember similar incidents perhaps, but I also can't think that this is the last of its kind.
Yeah, I think that even with teaching media that we go into this area of critical pedagogy, where even as professors, I try to tell my class that I can't be completely neutral with some of the things that I express to you, that I will tell them I'm a Japanese American woman that is in my 30s. So sometimes if I talk about things that are related to identity, that this is where I am coming from. And I think that he emphasizes on the idea that journalists, they're not completely faceless people that don't have an ethnicity, don't have a gender. And I think that it's hard to for sometimes us to see where the borders and boundaries are. We have like journalists, the journalist David Carr, who passed away a couple years ago, who wrote for the New York Times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And a lot of his writing was based upon this type of personality and passion. And he would include things like how he struggled with drugs and alcoholism. And it was this kind of like rock and roll type of journalist that made him very famous. So it's hard to see, like, okay, as a student, am I supposed to have this edgy or my personality in here, or am I supposed to be completely all about the facts?
So, Andrew, how do you portray that to students to try to separate? Because I many times, I mean, even before the internet, you know, talking to people who said, "Well, I thought so and so was such and such," and what they were doing was they had been reading opinion pieces, but couldn't identify the opinion pieces from the news.
I mean, it's especially challenging now, right? We have alternate facts are now part of the discussion, and you know, I think one of the challenges for journalists is that, you know, the effort to be neutral is really important when you're talking about an issue that is up for debate. And then the question that Wallace is bringing up is, you know, is it up for debate that, you know, trans people should be able to use a restroom? You know, the trans people should be able to live, that should be able to have a right to their identity. And so, you know, his point is that, you know, in this effort to be neutral, we sort of say, well, oh, you know, there's two sides. There's always two sides. You know, I think of a recent example, and I won't call out the journalist, but a regional journalist on one of the television networks posted a story online about a local man who, a local black man who is in a Walmart in Medford and overheard a child use the N-word, referring to him. And the article said a word that some people find racist. And I thought, okay, we're trying way too hard for objectivity. Mm-hmm. If we're saying some people view the N-word as racist, it's racist. That to me is an objective fact. And so I think, you know, I think what I try to communicate with students is that, you know, you can be balanced in coverage. You can, you know, reference another person's perspective without acting as if all perspectives are equally right. You can still present facts. You can still, you know, bring that context to it.
The media in general, our discussion topic here in a new segment on the Jefferson Exchange we call Signals and Noise. Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi are both on the faculty of the Communications Department at Southern Oregon University. You can join this discussion at 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Boy, the term objective facts was burning itself into my brain as you said it, because I was thinking, we're dealing at a time in history when you've got the President of the United States arguing with news organizations about, I mean, you had, forget the president himself, Sean Spicer came out the day after the inauguration and said this was the largest crowd to witness an inauguration, period. So you've got somebody trying to dictate information at a time when we've always thought that, you know, this was, you know, this is things are what they appear, you know, 2 + 2 = 4, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting to watch. One of the other things that we have on the list to talk about this week is Reuters. And let's see, January 31st, Reuters editor-in-chief Steve Adler wrote to the staff to say that, you know, we have to be aware of the fact that we cover lots of countries where the news media are not welcome. And this perhaps is the way to cover the Trump administration. How did that strike either of you at the time?
I think that I really liked that letter. I think that it was supportive of that we have a job to do, that there's going to be challenges ahead. I think that it's also important that we do keep in mind that we're living in a global world where the boundaries are being crossed through media. So we might not physically be in a place, but we're receiving all this kind of information from all over the world, which is very interesting in how our reporting is portrayed, how our countries are portrayed, and that I think being a journalist in general is very, very difficult. I went to Humboldt State, and that's when I first started to study journalism. Mac McClary was a professor there, and he would always emphasize that journalists, they should never take anything for free, which is a lot different now, because even having worked in print media, you're always getting like swag bags and
Free lunches and stuff.
Yeah, free lunches. Even like Donald Trump at one time had sponsored this buffet type of dinner for journalists. I think it was in early January. So in our country, we have this point in which journalists, they have to know that they'll be called out upon, that they might not be welcome, but also that their job is really, really important in communicating different types of information to our public.
I thought what was really significant about the Reuters article was that it sort of made the point that access isn't everything. And I think that sometimes journalists don't sort of confront falsehoods because they're afraid of losing the access. And I think the Reuters
they
made
could be kicked out of the White House.
Right, right. And yeah. I think the editor made the point that, you know, access isn't everything. We find ways to cover the important stories when they matter, and that's our first sort of principle.
And it goes beyond the national. I want to point this out too, because there's a really interesting local example recently of what does and does not get covered. Because since the election of Donald Trump, lots of groups have sprung up to oppose him. Some refer to themselves as a resistance. There's the group Indivisible, which has, I believe, marched every week since the beginning of the year to Greg Walden's office in Medford, the Congress member representing Oregon District 2. To redress or to ask for the redressing of some grievances. But there was actually a column from Kathy Noah, the editor of the Mail Tribune, one day explaining why they didn't cover all of the Indivisible protests. And I noticed that there was this week the most recent episode of Indivisible going to Greg Walden's office had a photo with caption but no story, at least in the printed version of the Mail Tribune. So, I mean, you get called to account by lots of people for lots of things when you work in the media business.
Yeah, I thought Kathy Noah's column was interesting. I agree that on the one hand, the media does not have a responsibility to cover, you know, every single protest, every single march. They, you know, there's only so much space and people's attention span to know everything. One thing I thought, again, going back to this sort of need for objectivity, kind of a note that I disagreed with was that she said covering a similar protest by the same group of people every week doesn't feel like balance to me. And I think that that's the wrong reason not to cover it. You know, for instance, if one group is protesting every week and another group is not, it doesn't strike me as imbalanced to cover the one that is. I think that's where we try to get this false equivalency of, oh, well, we must make sure the other side has equal weight. Well, if the other side isn't protesting every week, then they are not raising that voice.
But if the weeks stretch into years, for example, Women in Black, for example, protested for years about the Iraq War and may be out there still. I don't know, honestly. But, I mean, how long do you continue to do something that has become as regular as the Chamber of Commerce luncheon?
Right. And I think that's the challenge. I think my point is simply that I don't think we don't cover it because it feels imbalanced. I think we don't cover it if it's not news. And I think it goes back to what Reuters said. You know, they gave a list of do's and don'ts. And one thing they said, cover what matters in people's lives and provide them with facts they need to make better decisions. So, you know, if a protest is happening and it impacts the lives around us and it's something that's important for people about making decisions about how they vote or, you know, what ordinances they support, those kinds of things, I think it needs to be covered. Other times, maybe it doesn't.
So it's really about the content. I mean, if they're talking about health care, for example, which is a pressing issue for a lot of people, versus we just don't like Greg Walden. Would that make the difference?
I think it could. I think it could. And I say this as someone who, you know, absolutely thinks that citizens participating in these kind of demonstrations is important. I think we want more civic engagement. I think people should get their voices heard. But you can't expect to every time that the newspaper or, you know, local radio station is going to be able to cover it, because there's just always so much to cover.
Okay, listeners, what are your observations, your beefs with the way the media are handling things? And we can expand this beyond news media to basically all mass media. Join us on this segment called Signals and Noise with Andrew Gay and Precious Yamaguchi from the Communications Faculty at Southern Oregon University. Our phone number to join the conversation is 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And, of course, just as I'm talking about broadening this out from news media, we can actually talk about Super Bowl ads, because these were not meant to be objective in any way, shape, or form. They're trying to sell you something, but it was interesting that we have several ads in the Super Bowl that appeared, at least, to be addressing some of the issues of our time. The most notable, perhaps, 84 Lumber, with an ad that made you go, what's going on here? It looks like a woman and her daughter trekking across the Mexican desert, potentially heading for America, but you don't see that in the ad that played during the Super Bowl. All it says at the end is, go online to 84lumber.com to see the rest, which I did. About 2 minutes in, you see them coming face to face with the wall, as envisioned by Donald Trump.
And the reason that ad didn't air in full wasn't because they couldn't afford the airtime. It was because Fox told them no. I mean, Fox rejected. That is, of course, Fox Broadcasting, not Fox News. A different decision making process there. But you know, they decided that it was too controversial to air during the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting too how that that ad, it also has this type of multi-context in which Donald Trump was on the Jimmy Kimmel show, right? And I think that's when he mentioned the door that will be give people access mm-hmm. through this wall. And so I felt that watching the ad, it was a really, really long ad, like almost 8 minutes in total. And you're watching this almost as if it's kind of a little mini
movie,
which I think that it draws you in even more. But there was a lot of different types of dialogue that came about in terms of this ad. Is it pro wall? Is it not pro wall? There's a door that Donald Trump had mentioned.
And in fact, we have Maggie Hardy McGurko, the owner and CEO of 84 Lumber, told People magazine that she backs the border wall with Mexico and, in fact, is a backer of President Trump, but didn't intend to take a political stand with the emotional advertisement. She said that the message was in the eyes of the beholder. The tagline in the commercial is the will to succeed is always welcome here.
Right.
Which can be a little nebulous. I mean, I can see how people would go, okay, is this because they go through the door. I'm I'll be the spoiler here, but yeah, they actually go through the door because they can push it through the wall and get into the country.
Yeah, I think the company was kind of trying to have it both ways. I mean, I think most people watching the ad who aren't who don't know anything about the company or about her public statements about Trump or even who aren't thinking about Trump's statement about the big door, I think they would look at it and say like, oh, okay, this is sort of like sticking it to Trump a little bit. But you know, it seems to be they're sort of now framing it as if the door is a metaphor for legal immigration. That yes, we do need a wall, but as Trump says, there will be this big beautiful door that you can do if you go through the right process. So it seemed like the company was kind of trying to have it both ways. But I did find it interesting that the Super Bowl had so many ads that did seem to be intentionally reaching for diversity, particularly diversity of languages and ethnicities. We had the Coke ad from a few years ago come back. Mm-hmm. And once again, uproar on Twitter from some folks who feel like America the Beautiful should never be sung in any language other than English. So it's always kind of interesting to see what pops up at the Super Bowl, which is not necessarily what you would think of as like a major progressive event.
No. It's time for all Americans to get together. You generally have 170 million people or so watching this. Mm-hmm. The Budweiser, as we continue along the scale, then there was the Budweiser ad where you could see Adolphus Bush, I guess, getting told, go back where you came from when he gets off the boat from Germany. Airbnb had a diversity spot similar to Coca-Cola's. Mm-hmm. Melissa McCarthy, Saving the Whales, et cetera. Perhaps the most blatant Trump reference was in the It's a 10 hair care ad, the one that said we're in for at least 4 years of awful hair. Did you catch that one?
No, I think I missed that one.
I didn't see that one.
It was the one that showed the people with all kinds of wacky hairstyles. So, they definitely got out there. Okay, a couple minutes left here on Signals and Noise here on the Jefferson Exchange. You guys want to do a pick three segment where you talk about three bits of media or shows that you're paying attention to at the moment. So, Precious, why don't you take this one first?
Yeah, I think that in relationship to Black History Month, one of the shows or one of the things that's online on Amazon Prime that I saw that I would really encourage people to watch is Trevor Noah's African American stand-up comedy. I know a lot of people know Trevor Noah through The Daily Show, but when you see him do stand-up comedy and he talks about his experiences as a South African person coming to the United States, you really, really get a sense of this person is very smart and very, very funny. So I suggest that. Another one is Mozart in the Jungle with Gael Bernal Garcia. Also Monica Bellucci, who together they are just so steamy, like an incredible...
she does a guest part as an opera diva. I've seen it. Yeah.
And Jason Schwartzman. So I recommend that. And also, of course, when we think of media, to also read. I really enjoy reading The Whale by Philip Haar. I think that it's a great escape to, with all of the politics going on, to also look at the different dimensions of our planet and to see what's happening underneath the oceans and There's no better escape than to see what the life of a whale is like.
Get below the waves. Yes. A lot of the noises of the daily world sort of not present under the waves.
Yes.
That's good to think about. Thanks for that, Precious. Andrew, what are your pick three?
So, again, reflecting on the changing media times, my first one is also a streaming television series, One Day at a Time on Netflix, which is a remake of the Norman Lear show from the late 70s, early 80s.
Bonnie Franklin and Valerie Bertinelli.
Yeah.
Kenzie Phillips.
And now this version is about a Cuban American family. The single mom, is a veteran. It tackles all kinds of issues. I mean, it's a traditional three camera warm family sitcom, really funny, but it's tackling issues on gender, on PTSD, on sexual orientation, on immigration, all that kind of stuff. Really interesting to see a group of people tackle topics like this from that warm family sitcom sort of mode. My second one is, I gotta give a shout out to the Melissa McCarthy Sean Spicer sketch from SNL, which probably most people have seen at this point, but I've been watching it almost daily because I find it hilarious.
Unannounced, and I haven't seen the end of the show yet, but it appears that nobody ever said Melissa McCarthy's going to be on this show.
They just started
this sketch with Sean Spicer in the White House briefing Melissa McCarthy playing him.
Yeah, pretty amazing. And then my third for me is, I finally I subscribed to my local paper this week. And you know, I've been teaching media literacy for a while and talking about the fact that people need to get financially invested in journalism, particularly local news, because you know your national news outlets are not covering what's happening at your city council. And so I finally bit the big one and subscribe to the Daily Tidings. And I recommend all of our listeners, if you don't subscribe to your local paper, you should. Journalism is so important, and so much of what happens on cable news is really being broken by newspaper journalists who are then getting covered by cable news,
right,
but aren't getting paid for that. So that's one thing I did this week.
And as ad revenue has declined across the commercial media business, it just becomes that much more important for the people who do consume the news to go ahead and put some money in there too. So it's definitely an interesting time in the history of journalism on both the business end of things and certainly on what gets covered, but an interesting media landscape for sure. And I'm glad we had a chance to take a look at the signals and noise with Precious Yamaguchi and Andrew Gay, both from the communications department at Southern Oregon University. A lot of fun. Let's do this again.
Thank you.